but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
Truth.
Well, it'll be Oregon and it'll be Penn State tomorrow in Happy Valley. It'll be Oregon State and Houston tonight in Corvallis. Whole bunch of college football for your weekend, NFL for the weekend. We have a great show for you today. It'll be fast moving with a lot of big guests. I'm so excited about Oregon Penn State, excited about tonight's college football game at Reser Stadium. Jerry DiNardo of the Big Ten Network going to be joining us here in just a couple minutes. We'll have Jake Butt of the Big Ten Network as well on the program. Plus, we'll take another visit to Happy Valley and get a little flavor, boots on the ground in Happy Valley. What is the scene, Oregon and Penn State, taking place tomorrow? Jerry DiNardo, former college football coach, college football player, studio analyst with the Big Ten Network, man of the world, kid from Queens, joining us now. How are you, Coach?
I'm doing great, John. Thanks for having me.
Give us an idea. What's it like? What was it like to grow up in Queens?
Well, it was Brooklyn and Queens. I went to high school in Brooklyn. My dad was a New York City cop. Had a great experience. Played a lot of sports. Went to good schools. Very, very fortunate. My entire life can be termed fortunate. It started there, and I'm very thankful for everything I've had.
The upbringing as a son of a New York City cop, what comes with that?
I guess caring about other people, service, obeying, respecting people in authority. I think my mom would add a little bit of apprehension every time he left the house. Was he going to come back? I don't think I ever felt that way. I think I was probably too young. I was the youngest of four boys. So the time my dad had put 20 years in the police force, you know, most of it was I was younger. So I guess that's it. I mean, I think we were always proud of our dad for being a New York City cop. And like I say, it was a great experience. Maybe not so much for my mom, but for the rest of us, it was.
They must have been proud of you. You go off to Notre Dame at a time when, you know, the glow of that dome, I don't know if it was ever brighter in that, you know, sort of in that couple of decades that of football there. But what was that experience like for you?
Well, it was interesting. You know, my brother Larry was a Notre Dame All-American. He was captain of Ara's 1970 team, I think, or 71. So I was following in his footsteps, and it almost made me not go. I was going to go to North Carolina. I didn't want to follow in Larry's footsteps, but I decided to do it. And so that was something that I had to, you know, put behind me and not worry about it so much. I played in Arizona's 1973 national championship team, and I played in his last game. And so I can't tell you what an experience that was. He was a unique coach that was ahead of his time. And just a wonderful, wonderful person. And my 4 years there, I wouldn't trade them for much of anything.
That, you know, I covered Notre Dame for one season. Bob Davey was the coach and didn't quite have the shine that it had in your era. But people always look back to those teams that you were on. And, of course, Rudy, you know, was Rudy a teammate of yours, Rudy Rudiger?
Rudy was a friend before he was a teammate. We were friends when he was at Holy Cross. And then when he came to Notre Dame, obviously our friendship grew. So he was on the scout team when I was there. And people ask me about the movie all the time, how accurate it was. And I wasn't there when he played. I had graduated. But the part about him being at Holy Cross and everything he endured to get to Notre Dame was the part that I was part of. And he was Tom Clements was one of my roommates who was our quarterback, and Rudy was always hanging out in our room when he was at Holy Cross. And And the part that I lived was very accurately portrayed. I wasn't there for when he played. So I've enjoyed watching that, especially the part I was there for, because it was all true.
Jerry DiNardo, our guest, a Big Ten Network analyst now. Oregon, Penn State, I'm obviously traveling to this game. Oregon, beats Penn State in the Big Ten title game. You saw that one. I think you were there last year. And now you've got Penn State hosting this game. What do you make of it? Where's your brain on this one right now?
Yeah, I said yesterday on Big Ten Today, I think what could separate these two would be explosive plays. And traditionally people think of explosive plays just offensively. I look at it both offensively and defensively. And I would give the advantage to explosive plays on offense to Oregon because they've been more explosive going into the game. The other thing is Penn State hasn't been all that explosive in the pass game. They're better than they were a year ago, but they really don't threaten the depth of the field a lot. So that makes them explosive maybe in the run, but not in the pass. So I think explosives, if that's a factor, Oregon would win it with their offense. On the other hand, I think there's more explosive possibilities with the defense. And not many people think of explosives in the defense, but explosives in the defenses are sacks, are fumbles, are running a linebacker through that the offensive line doesn't pick up. And I think for this game, I give the edge to Penn State with that for a couple reasons. That's kind of how Jim Knowles, the defensive coordinator, is built. But, John, they also have had 2 weeks to get ready for this game. So you can put more defenses in that are not on tape. You can do more with personnel. He's got some great pass rushes. They may not line up where they've always lined up before in the past. And that means that the offensive line might have to shift protection. Quarterback may have to make a call. So I think the defensive explosives favor Penn State. Offense favors Oregon.
The experience Knowles had in seeing Oregon and Will Stein twice last season, how big a factor is that?
I think it's significant. I think when you're at this, when you're at that level and you're in coaching, and you have all the technology and you have unlimited staffs and you can just dig deep and deep and deeper into everything that's going to happen or everything that you think is going to happen. And you add, you've done this before versus this coordinator or this offense or this defense. I think it can be significant. I mean, you know, Will Stein, does he have to be ready for everything? Maybe. Or does the whiteout, Urban and I did a piece on the whiteout, and one of the points that Urban made on Urban Analysis is that you can't run as many deceptives because they take too much communication in some instances. Now, Will Stein may not agree with that, but he ran like five or deceptive trick plays, whatever you want to call them. He ran like five or seven of them against Oklahoma State. Nobody runs that many. And so that, that's a factor as well. Jim will have to be ready for everything, even though it looks like the whiteout could slow some of the trick stuff down.
I saw, Oregon ran a fake punt against Oregon State last week, and I thought they didn't need to do that. Are they trying to get something on tape to make Penn State, react and have to spend time in practice or spend time in a film session on that? I mean, you're a coach. You tell me. What are they doing?
Yeah, I mean, John, you're exactly right. Right. So they're sitting there saying, okay, are they doing that just so we have to defend it?
Yeah.
They really want to do it. Right. Yeah, absolutely. You put it on tape. But then just like you summarized, they didn't have to do it. So is Penn State sitting there saying, they didn't have to do that. They just did that. So
yeah.
We would, yeah. So it's very funny, but it's also true. It'll be interesting. One of the most difficult things in the whiteout is to punt the ball because of communication and protection. So to have a gadget or deceptive in that part of the game is going to be real difficult. The other problem is even on a field goal, if the offensive line can't hear when that ball is snapped and they don't step and the offensive line don't step with their inside foot towards the center quick enough because they can't hear it, that's how you get a blocked field goal. So special teams are incredibly challenged in the whiteout.
The wideout situation, you know, obviously you've coached in that conference. I think Penn State was a fairly recent member of the Big Ten when you were at IU. What is that environment like for people who haven't been there?
Well, you know, even in the non-wideout games, I think it's one of the great venues in the country. You know, you deal with it. I think Big Ten coaches are used to dealing with it. SEC coaches are used to dealing with their tough places to play. And I think the kids get used to it. You know, they're so smart and they're so tuned in. They spend an incredible amount of time getting ready for these games. You know, I say these are the, you know, greatest college athletes that have ever played. Technology and the amount of hours that they spend. It's a year-round sport and all that. So it's a tough place to play, and obviously the whiteout probably makes it one of the most toughest, if not the toughest.
You were in the SEC as well, and you know, I've been to, I think, two SEC stadiums, but I got a taste of the Big Ten, and certainly the big stadiums in the Big Ten are huge and impressive, especially for West Coast people who are coming east. But can you compare a little bit of the SEC in your time there to what you see in Big Ten stadiums and the fans, and how are these schools and the expectations different or similar?
Yeah, I think all fans have expectations. That's, you know, to win all the games and get the national championship ring. So the expectations don't change for the, you know, the haves and the tops of both conferences. You know, I would say my time in the SEC, you know, obviously when I was at LSU, we had one of the best environments, maybe the best environment when we were winning. I'd say Florida was difficult to play and communicate. I remember those. So one was a home, one was away. Other than Florida, you know, Georgia maybe a little bit, but it wasn't like Florida. You know, Steve Spurrier was at Florida and I was at LSU, so when we played in his place, you know, it got really, really loud for us. And then when he came to our place, it got really, really loud for him. So to me, I guess my experience in the SEC is the two toughest was home field for me at LSU, and away was Florida at that time.
Jerry DiNardo, coach, former player at Notre Dame, analyst on the Big Ten Network, is with us. I like Penn State in this game. I think they need it, and I think James Franklin needs this game. But you've been a coach. How much does that stuff hang over your head when you rush for 300 yards and lose in a Big Ten title game, and people are going, "Oh, he can't win the big one." How much of that is difficult to tune out and just focus on what you need to do?
Difficult, yes, but I might suggest to you a little bit easier now. I said this on our show yesterday when I was asked basically the same question by Dave Revson. After Ryan Day lost to Michigan, did we ever think it was going to get any worse for Ryan Day? I mean, all the crazy fans and the crazy nonsense that he's had to put up with. But you know what? He got through it. He had a team meeting, and he won the national championship. So, yes, Penn State loses. It'll be James can't win the big one, and yet he can still win the national championship. So let's hold off on that. So as a coach, that's what I would be thinking as a coach. If we won the game, I'd congratulate everybody, let them party and do whatever they wanted. And then the next time I had a team meeting, I'd say, okay, this doesn't mean we've invented the game. This doesn't mean that we're the best team in the conference or in the country. It just means that we had one hell of a win. It was great. Now it's behind us. And if we lost the game in this situation, I would say, hey, Ohio State did it a year ago. We can do it this year. You know, I mean, give them examples where it's really not the end of the world. And, you know, the next game is more important. The end of the world would be if we lose to someone that we're supposed to beat next week because we lost yesterday.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yes. You know, Oregon last year went through that. I think Dan Lanning on the field after beating Ohio State at Autzen Stadium, it looked like it was a season-ending victory. Like that, the celebration, there was a big catharsis. Lanning was smiling, and I thought, oh, I wonder if this comes back to get him. And, you know, it proved it was a long season. The game's different now. The season feels so long to me. Does it feel long to you with the playoff?
Yeah. Yeah, it's long. And again, credit to these young people. You know, one of the things I do every year, which is probably one of my favorite things to do every year, is to go to all these camps and watch them practice. And, you know, we're not recording. And, you know, we talk to the coaches. We kind of get inside. You know, we're kind of media. Yeah, I mean, we're obviously partners with the Big Ten. It's the first time ever, you know, this has happened where 18 years ago, a media outlet and a conference became business partners. And so, you know, we get an inside look on a lot of this stuff. And I'm just amazed at the dedication of these players and how much they work. More players played last year with degrees than any other time in the history of college football. So nobody can say that we forgot it's an academic endeavor. We're graduating at a higher rate. We've broken our – we broke 2024 record of graduates in 2025. So for the last 2 years when all the changes have happened, more people have graduated and still played college football. So it's pretty cool that they're this dedicated and yet they're still going to school and doing a good job.
Dylan Gabriel last year, I had him on the show a few times, and one of the times I forgot, you know, how, you know, about the money in college football. And I said to Gabriel, I said, you know, are you soaking up the fact that life is simpler now, that when you turn pro and you get drafted, that, you know, it'll get more complex? And he says, he just paused and he says, John, I don't know how to tell you. He says, we're pros now. And, yeah. And I thought to myself, you know, how much has changed? If for you, it has to feel wild, be given what you came up in as a player.
Yes, but. My attitude is this, okay? When I was in college, I got room, books, board, and tuition. Like we've talked, my dad was a cop, so it didn't cost my family anything for me to go to school. Eric Parsegian was my head coach, one of the greatest coaches in the history of the sport, was not allowed to make any more than the highest paid professor on campus. That was a Father Hesburgh rule, okay? So he had to get another job. So he opened up an insurance company. So that was fair to me, right? I mean, he wasn't rolling in the money, and I didn't have, my parents didn't have to pay a penny. But when you start paying Lincoln Riley $100 million for 10 years and think that he's not going to take a snap, he's not going to block anybody, how do you not change the dynamic? John, do you know this? When I first got into coaching, that, you know what the Pell Grant is?
Yes.
Are you familiar?
Yeah.
Okay, so when I first got into coaching, we had a team, we'd have team meetings, and we would pass out the Pell Grant forms to everyone, even if we were in someone's home that we knew wouldn't qualify. We weren't going to embarrass anybody. So everyone filled out the Pell Grant, and then we sent them in. The NCAA made a rule that the student athlete could not accept the Pell Grant.
Wow.
So the government money was awarded to our universities that we were all working at. It was against the rules to give it to them, and they put it in the athletic department's budget. So we would go recruit someone that room, books, board, and tuition was a great deal, just like it was for my dad, right? For me, with my mom and my dad. But my mom and dad could afford to, you know, send me a plane ticket from South Bend. They could afford to come see me play.
Yep.
Some people, without the Pell Grant, none of that could happen.
Yeah.
And the NCAA was taking that money from them.
Ridiculous.
And so the gloves are off. I'm happy with all this stuff. I mean, there's, you know, I mean, and the other thing about the portal, what a lot of people don't know, like for 100 years or whatever, everybody but football, men's and women's basketball, hockey, and baseball, if I have the five correct, they were always allowed to transfer without penalty. So I could be sitting in a Notre Dame classroom back in the day, and some woman volleyball player could be next to me, and she could say, Jerry, I'm going to UCLA next year. And I said, you're going to sit out a year? And she would say to me, sit out a year? What are you talking about? So the 1 year in residency wasn't for every athlete. So football players were treated differently. It was more restrictive for them. Why? So a coach could control his roster.
Yeah.
So the university could make more money on football. So it made it harder for someone to transfer. So the history of all this stuff leads you to believe this is fair. It hasn't always been fair by design of the NCAA.
I think we're going to look back and we're going to go, why didn't the NCAA get there sooner? And, you know, in a more proactive way instead of the reactive stuff that I think, you know, caused everybody to get whiplash. And I think that, you know, had they just come to you, all right, you can get a Pell Grant, or by the way, we're going to share some revenue with you as the money and the TV money was infused into college football, that should have been shared with the athletes. And we'll see where it ends up. Do you think football should split away? Do you see, would that be beneficial in some ways, or too complicated?
Well, what worries me about that is if everybody has to stay compliant in Title IX. I mean, in 1972, when Title IX was passed, our daughters had the same opportunities as our sons, and that can't be changed. And so if you're going to separate, and it's going to cost us, Title IX cost us some men's sports. We know that because of the ratio. I don't want anything to cut women's sports. And if separating means, I wouldn't want men's sports cut either, but I mean, especially the women, if separation means that they're going to challenge Title IX, whether it's out in the open or behind closed doors, I'm against it. I need to know Title IX lives.
I'm with you on that. All right, Coach, before I let you go, I said all week I was having you on the show, and I had listeners reach out, and they said, okay, love him, love watching him. Can you help him with the pronunciation of Oregon? And you're not alone in saying Oregon, but people want you to say Oregon. Rick Majerus and I did this, and then Majerus, the next time he came on, he went Oregon, and I go, you're doing that on purpose, aren't you? But that's an East Coast thing, isn't it? Like, people say Oregon.
I guess. You got me in the puzzle. Now, okay, right. So say it again the proper way.
Just do it in two syllables. Or, like O-R, and then gun, like Oregon.
Oregon.
There it is.
Oregon. O-R-G-U-N. Oregon.
Yeah, just say Oregon. Like, or, you know, like, you don't play a piano, you play an organ.
Oh, I can do that.
Do that.
No, that's going to sound funny.
No.
Organ. That's not.
No, that's it. Really? That's right. Yes. Organ.
Oh, you're freaking me out now.
No. Next time you think about it as a piano, not a piano. It's an organ.
It's an organ. Okay.
There it is.
I'm in.
That's like, that's like people say Boise. The people in Boise don't like it. They like it Boise instead of Boise. They want Boise. Yeah, I'm not going to confuse you with that one.
You are killing me.
I know I am. But just remember, not a piano.
Organ.
It's an organ.
It's an organ. Okay, everyone on the set is going to look at me. I'm just telling you.
I love it. No, they're not. They're going to love you for it. You're going to say, hey, you got coached up. See, you're coachable all these years later. Still coachable. Jerry DiNardo, you're the best. Thank you for doing this. I appreciate you.
Thanks, John.
All right. Take care, man.
Thank you, bet. Bye-bye.
And there he goes. See, that's the public service that we provide on this show. I had a few listeners go, can you please help him? It's Oregon, not Oregon. And I remember doing this with Rick Majerus years and years and years ago, the late, great Utah coach, basketball coach. And he would come on and go, Oregon. And the next time he'd come on, he'd do it again. Jerry DiNardo, good stuff from him. We have a great show for you on this Friday. You got the bald-faced truth. Leave it here.